Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, we're going to have a bit of fun.
On a small level in your backyard, when you get something wrong, it's maybe an anecdote. When you do it with billions of dollars, it's funny tragic.
Laughter is often the best way to deal with difficult or complicated issues, so it's no wonder that it also applies to city living and urbanism, making it more accessible to the general public. This week, we meet the team behind Utopia, a TV show about a building authority. We hear how parody and humour can be found in the architectural world too, and we give you a rundown of some urbanism references in popular culture, stand-up comedy, and more. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's episode of The Urbanist. I'm your MC for today, so pull up a chair and get comfy. As the founder of production company Working Dog, Rob Sitch is part of the production team behind hit Australian TV shows Frontline and Have You Been Paying Attention? Their latest offering, Utopia, also known as Dreamland internationally, has a decidedly urban tone and has just finished its fourth season. It follows a fictional government organisation, the Nation Building Authority, that's tasked with bringing major infrastructure projects to life. Here, bureaucracy collides with grand ambitions, providing perfect comedy fodder.
Numbers just don't stack up.
You've got to look beyond the numbers. Vision, Tony.
Jim.
If we'd listened to the bean counters, we never would have built the Snowy.
The Snowy was a white elephant.
Are you kidding me? The Snowy forged this nation.
But I don't think it's ever turned a profit.
Oh, stop it. I'm not even going to listen to that.
But environmentally, it was a disaster.
Hydroelectricity? I did a project on that at school.
But it supplies like less than 1% to the grid.
And what about everything else the Snowy's given us?
What else?
That miniseries?
Jim, they're white elephants, just like the very fast train. The numbers don't stack up.
Rob, who wrote and stars in the show, joined me earlier to explain how cities and their governments inspired the series.
Infrastructure became a sort of substitute word for sort of national dreams and aspirations. And since we started this series with the fictional office, every state in our country, which, you know, is the 5 or 6 or 7 of them, have launched their own infrastructure office, which which imitates ours. So it's one of those curious things, is that when sort of the politicians and advisors watched our show, they learnt two things from it. One, they tend to look silly, but the other was, gee, that's a really good idea to have an office devoted to infrastructure. And we got to the idea through various motivations. One was, in my hometown of Melbourne, we lived through a very, very severe drought. And out of the blue, our premier announced that they were going to build a desalination plant. Now, I don't think the mathematics supported it, but it was a really smart political decision. The only trouble was, the day he announced it, it started raining and it didn't stop. And so it's the only desalination plant in the world that was delayed due to flooding.
And tell me that one of the great things about the show is it just kind of shows you how many of these grand projects are actually stymied or promoted by politicians and by grabbing headlines or trying to get out of the headlines, as you said, rather than the mathematics at the core. Was that one of the things that you were keen to explore in this program?
Yeah, and it's two-sided. It's one is just about every big project in Australia blows out. And now they've got smart about that. What they do is they announce a blowout figure to begin with, which is 3 times the logical budget. And then when it does blow out, it looks like they're on budget. So they've got smarter at this stuff. But there's various examples. What we love is that human beings are, I think, justifiably not very good at planning decades in advance. And there's a misalignment of incentives that we seem to go through prime ministers faster than you guys. And so the incentive to come up with something that sounds good within 3 months is much better than coming up with something that works out in 10 years. But there's some great examples in Australia. One is the Sydney Opera House, which I think holds the crown for the highest percentage blowout of any major infrastructure in the world. And yet, here's the kicker. If you see it in person, you'll agree that it's close to one of the most beautiful buildings in the world. And it's not a very good opera house, to be honest. So when I was saying this to someone, so they said, oh, have you heard that Athens almost went broke when they built the Parthenon? And I sort of think, so I have empathy for people that are trying to plan 10 or 20 years in advance. But it seems like in the past we had Basil Gett and these kind of guys running around doing amazing infrastructure works. And now we just not that great at it.
Now, tell me, when we look through the seasons, at the kinds of projects that you had focused on, there was the feasibility for a fast train connecting Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. There was an attempt by a developer to add numerous stories to a single building and lobbying the National Building Authority to get their, to get their help. How many of these were based on stories that you'd actually kind of seen in the press, and how many things were your fantasy drawing board for your utopia?
In developing it, we will speak, I've got a friend of mine who builds high-rise construction, and I was chatting him to him one day, and he was talking about a thing that he was doing, and it was going to add amenity to the city, and it was going to be integrated and sustainable, and he paused. He said, of course, none of that matters because all I care about is height. And so we based an episode around that, and we've been going through a rather significant building boom in my hometown. And it was funny, when he alerted me to that, you just saw all these buzzwords bouncing everywhere, green roofs, six-star sustainability. But buried seven paragraphs down was, and they've applied to the council to have 15 more stories. And that's where the economics lie.
No, completely. It's nice that you can build the tallest skyscraper in the world, but if it's got a bit of sedum on the top, then you're onto a good game. You can claim you're feeding a few passing birds as you get ever higher. Have you spoken to people in planning authorities, in government, who have watched this and recognised themselves, whether it's the kind of morning stretch at their desk, which seems to take up a lot of time as well? Has there been a bit of recognition in it?
Yeah, so it's become a bit of a phenomenon in Australia. I think for two reasons. It looks very closely at the evolving office environment. You know, I often say that we take a two-year gap between series, and within that 2 years, people invent another dozen buzzwords that didn't exist in the last series. The last one is decluttering. You know, it's, and suddenly people that have never thought about decluttering in their lives start quoting Marie Kondo, whoever she is. But it's a bit of a circle of life that keeps renewing itself, thank God. But people graciously come up to us all the time and say, look, we refer to utopia moments all the time in our offices, and that's been really gratifying. It pops up in the press a lot here. I think people enjoy it because everyone is aware of this infrastructure boom, but there wasn't a sort of a language to describe the stuff-ups and the hiccups that come with that process. And in some ways, the word infrastructure, we thought the series was going to die if the phrase town planning got attached to our show, because town planning, probably unfairly, just feels like one of the most boring nomenclatures you could ever choose. But infrastructure is about dreams. And once we hooked into that, but I think in some ways it's fair to say it's changed the language, the political language in this country whenever someone talks about dreams. It's always about nation building now. And to be honest, not much of it is.
For something to be funny, do people need to care about it? Is that why I've watched lots of bits of your shows and, yeah, there is the office comedy, all these strange competing competitions to kind of get things through the system. But in the end, for something to be funny, do you think that it kind of helps that people see some recognition in those kind of utopia projects?
Yeah, and I think what the interesting thing is, I used to say that it's about scale. And when you scale up stupidity with it, then it becomes really quite funny. So if you make a mistake with the metric system and the imperial system when you build, you know, an extension to your house, it's annoying and relatively private. But if you make a mistake when you build the Hubble telescope, which they did, and they put in one imperial measurement when it should have been metric, and you fire a $1 billion Canberra satellite thing into the sky and then find out it can't take pictures, there's something, I mean, it's tragic, but there's something hilarious about the scale of that. And that's the thing that we're interested in. The north part of Australia has a wet season and it has enormous amounts of rain land on it. And people have eyed that particularly wet part of Australia for years and thought we can turn the rivers inland, we can pipe the water down south. And the dream hits an economic nightmare pretty quickly. But they built a big dam up there called the Old River Scheme. And when we were researching episodes, it felt like it was a story out of The Onion. It was one disaster after another. They kept trying to grow crops. And on the surface of it, it sounded like a great idea. Build a dam up, we've got this water, we've got massive amounts of sunshine. But they didn't count on the local breed of geese that once they worked out this crop was growing there, multiplied in their millions and came and ate all the crops. And so it was just one crop failure after another. And on a small level in your backyard, when you get something wrong, it's maybe an anecdote. When you do it with billions of dollars, it's funny tragic.
Rob Sitch of Utopia, thank you so much for joining us from Melbourne. This is The Urbanist. Michela Rosso is an Associate Professor of Architectural History at the Polytechnic of Turin, and she's also the editor of the recently released book Laughing at Architecture, Architectural Histories of Humour, Satire and Wit. The book charts the relationship between architecture and public opinion through comedy from the 18th century to the present day. In 13 essays, it examines a wide range of visual and literary media, from cinema to TV shows to satirical cartoons, showing how humour has been used to critique the role buildings and cities play in our lives. I sat down with Michela earlier to discuss the book and what it teaches us about the places we live, work and play in.
The advent of modernity became the target of humour because this was, of course, something that was wearing, in a way, the public. I'm thinking, for instance, to the World Exhibitions, to the Crystal Palace, that was judged as a sort of monster and also was depicted by cartoonists at the time. There was one cartoonist called George Augustus Sala that represented the Crystal Palace as a house of cards, probably referring, expressing doubts on the reliability of its iron structure that by the time was quite innovative and probably also quite uncertain on the point of view of structural stability in a way.
When you looked at these stories of laughing at architecture, why did you think they were important? Are they important at giving us a guide, for example, to the changing tastes of times? Because what's also interesting is this isn't only criticism from what might be meanly called lowbrow or from the street. This is also people in power pointing the finger at change that they don't like. What was the significance you felt about these moments when people laughed at architecture?
Yes, actually, taste and style and matters of aesthetics are only one part of the story. I mean, caricatures, cartoons, and all these kinds of humorous expressions, also verbal poems and rhymes, and sometimes they are dealing with taste. Most of the time they are dealing with taste and style, but some cases taste and style and aesthetics arguments are only the tip of the iceberg of a more general and more profound kind of criticism which tackles also political and social issues. It is the case, for instance, of an episode that is included in the book, is probably the third chapter, dealing with the celebrated cartoon by George Cruikshank, published in 1824, on John Nash, architect of All Souls Church at the end of Regent Street, which is kind of impaled on the spire of this building. So here, of course, the criticism is against the spire as the eccentric feature of this building. But also the cartoons is a criticism against the architect and through the architect against the power, the authority that allows, that enables the architect to work and to design. Because, of course, John Nash was responsible for all the Regent Street improvement and Regent's Park. So there is behind this cartoon not only a criticism of aesthetics, but methods of aesthetics are kind of instrument in order to open up a criticism that is wider and embraces more political and social issues.
And Michela, could you just finally tell me, architects, how have they used this notion of humour themselves?
Well, there are cases in which I found humor used by architects, of course. If you think of postmodern architects, for instance, I don't know, the so-called postmodern architects, I'm thinking of Bob Venturi, for instance, how he used parody in his drawings and also in his projects, but also other names like Stanley Tigerman in his Archie Tombs or his famous photomontage of Miss van der Rohe Crown Hall building, which is sinking in Lake Michigan, which is, of course, an autobiographical representation of his desire to kind of liberate himself from the dictates of modern architecture, the modern movement, and international style and corporate professional culture. Also, other names are the ones of Leon Krier. Leon Krier, for example, has made a series of cartoons criticizing modern architecture, and other names like Gustav Peichel, for example. So there are a number of architects using irony, caricatures, both as a sort of self-reflective attitude or self-critical practice that they have been doing on their work.
That was Michaela Rosso of the Polytechnic of Turin talking about her new book, Laughing at Architecture. As we've heard, comedy is a powerful tool to make urbanism and city matters more accessible to the public. Everyone can relate to a malfunctioning metro system, potholes that don't get fixed, or a new eyesore built in your city's downtown. References to urban themes can be found across pop culture, stand-up comedy specials, and late-night TV shows. Monocle's Nick Manise knows a thing or two about this world. You see, Nick also has his own stand-up comedy show, Urban Jungle, where he uses humour to explore how we're shaped by architecture, landscape and urban design. And he joins me in the studio now to talk about not only his work, I hope, but to go through some of these other pop culture references too. Nick, how did you stumble upon merging the world of urbanism and being a stand-up comic?
I think it's that whole thing where I had two things I loved and I was like, well, why don't I just throw them together? Like, I worked as a landscape architect and urban designer, and then I was also working as a comedian, and I was like, it would just be beautiful if I could bring them together. Because they say write what you know, and I guess that is what I know. And you know, if you spend any time with me and my girlfriend on the weekend, you'll know that I'm
not doing that.
Well, no, I'm just inviting you. If you'd like to come for a walk around London, okay. You'll see I'm constantly critiquing the human scale of buildings, and, okay. And I just thought if I could fold that into my stand-up, it'd be a nice...
God, she has a great weekend. And doesn't she?
It's thrilling.
And people can tell from your accent you're from the East End of London.
Yep, that's correct. That's where we all move.
Where did you practice your skills?
In Perth. In Western Australia, on the West Coast, the most isolated city in the world.
Okay. Well, I don't know whether this is wise or not. We've agreed, reluctantly, to play two clips of you in action.
Yep.
First of all, this is called The Intangibles of City Memory and Culture. Or is that just how it's been written down here in the script? Is that the actual name of this clip?
So I guess I do a stand-up full-hour show about urbanism. It's called Urban Jungle.
Are you trying to get bookings or something?
I mean, I've got two shows on the East Coast early next year. So if anyone's interested, feel free to come along. But basically, I break it up into the intangibles of a city. So we're talking about memory and culture. And then I move on towards the more tangible things like policy and actual built form design. So this first clip I think we're going to play is just a little bit of stand-up about culture in cities.
Well, let's have a listen.
All different cities and towns in Australia have different cultures. Like Perth's got a beach culture, Melbourne's got a coffee culture, Margaret River's got permaculture. you know, Adelaide's got to take you to the outback and murder you kind of culture. And it's embodied in the designs and the way we value designs in these different cities. Like you look at Perth, you know, outside of the stadium, outside of football, the project that we spent the most on in the past few years is $80 million on Scarborough Beach, you know. Hasn't changed a thing, though. Actually, it's changed a few things. Now, at least, when you get King Hit, you land on some nice terrazzo, you know what I mean? It's like, fuck, is this Italian?
Do you change the act so that you don't kind of upset each city you're in? If you're in Adelaide, you kind of say how great Adelaide is.
Yeah, I mean, it has to change depending on where you're doing it. So I've also done the show in London and I had to rewrite the material for London. And that was a specific joke, obviously, about Perth. But when I'm in Adelaide, I'll adapt it for Adelaide, Melbourne, likewise. So
Well, and there's another one which we're going to listen to now, which is about bike laws. Now, I know that Australia's a bit of a nanny state when it comes to bicycling. Is this what that's going to touch on?
Yeah, so I'm going to get stuck into, I guess, what I see as a problem with our biking laws in Australia.
The New South Wales Police were trying to protect bike riders, not by targeting people that were driving aggressively or too close to them, but by increasing the dollar value of the fines that they give them. Like, that was how they were protecting them. Like, they were going to hit them with harder fines if they weren't wearing a helmet. That would be like if someone got stabbed in King's Cross, you fine them $500 for not wearing a Kevlar vest. You know, like, that's... It doesn't add up for me. And like, before we get too preachy, I want to make the distinction. Like, I'm a bike rider, I'm not a cyclist. Like, cyclists cause congestion on the roads and in coffee shops on Saturday mornings. But bike riders are good for everyone. For me, when someone gets mad at a bike rider, that's like getting mad at someone that's chosen to use natural medicine. You know, they're not clogging up the system. They're not costing the taxpayers any money. And there's a good chance they'll be dead soon anyway. So...
That's a little bit edgier. Sorry.
No, that's good. It's good. Do we get 10% on the bookings, do you think? Is that a fair scrape?
That seems like a fair split. I'm happy with that.
Now, you're not the only funny Australian. God, I'm picking you up more here than I intended. Tom Gleeson is a bit of a hero of yours. What's Tom Gleeson got to do with The Urbanist?
I think it comes back to stand-up in general. And when people are writing, and it's like I said earlier, you're writing about what you know. You're writing about the minutiae of your daily life or your experience or things that are, I guess, impacting you and making you feel something. And because we all live in cities, because so many of us live in urban environments, inevitably just a regular stand-up comedy set is going to include some urbanism issues. And like I said, I think Tom Gleeson, I think he's the best comedian in Australia, but he tackled some global warming in a show in 2014 and looking at the global warming policies of our then Prime Minister, Tony Abbott. So I think we're going to throw to a clip now of Tom breaking down Tony Abbott's climate policies.
He was saying there's no relationship between bushfires and climate change whatsoever. We had major bushfires in 1850, 1939, 1968, 1983, 1994, 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007. If you had a science minister, he could have drawn you a fucking graph, mate.
Just tell me a little bit, who is Tom Gleeson then?
He rose to prominence in the early 2000s on a sketch show in Australia. He was playing a character called the Australian Fast Bowler, who was a superhero that, I guess, solved problems by bowling really, really fast. So typically Australian. It was an absolute hit. And so he's a TV personality, but I guess his main body of work is all about his stand-up comedy. So, and I guess what I liked about that is that it's getting the broader public to think about or consider topics that they might rather not read about or they might find too depressing. You know, Tony Abbott at the time... still is a climate change denier, and that was what that whole bit was about. And you know what, you might see Tony Abbott in the news talking about climate change and you're just going to switch off because you know it's not going to be anything actually progressive or making any sort of changes. And I think that's where I like this sort of comedy, when we're talking about issues that people don't necessarily want to unpack on their own, but if you can make it fun and lighthearted and jovial and still make a point, I think that's really poignant and really important.
We're going to move on to public transport. Hey, there's a good topic for humour, hey? And Hassan Minhaj, the Patriot Act. What's this?
So Hassan Minhaj is an American comedian and writer, and he's got a show on Netflix called The Patriot Act, which I guess deals with issues all over America. And obviously public transport, it's our, you know, everyone complains about it. There's always something wrong with it. You know, in London, there's nothing worse than the tubes going down on your way to work and all of a sudden the platform packs up and you're all of a sudden being squashed into sardines when your train eventually arrives 15 to 20 minutes late. So we've all got, I guess, this sort of negative attachment or association with public transit, or at least a lot of people do because of the problems that they face. And what Hassan Minhaj was trying to unpack was like, hey, these issues aren't actually to do with public transit. It's the way that it's managed and the way that it's governed in the United States. And they were focusing particularly in this story on a move by Charles and David Koch, who are, I guess, car, oil, gas billionaires, and their attempts to kill transit in Nashville. So this little clip that we're going to play is in the lead up to that.
Your train sucks because there are hidden forces around the country that want you in your car. And that's what I want to focus on tonight. American public transportation is under attack. From the top down at the federal level and from the bottom up at the local level, America is killing public transit the same way a second grade class kills their take-home hamster. Nobody's blameless, but some people did more damage than others. Just so you know, Brett Russo definitely killed our second grade hamster.
So I guess some of these clips, you know, they're funny in themselves and they are satire. And others are trying to get people a bit angry about things, like, you know, certainly the ones about global warming, about public transport. It's kind of almost stuff to get people out on the streets.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it might be naive to say that a stand-up comedy set is going to completely change people or convert climate change deniers to, you know, people that acknowledge that it's happening or change the Koch brothers' approach to transit. But I think what it does is it starts to get people thinking, and that's all that we want it to be. It's about creating a dialogue and start to get people to look at things in a new way. And I think the power of comedy is to make very difficult topics palatable. You know, it's that whole thing where comedy is tragedy plus time. And a lot of these issues that we're dealing with, you know, whether it's me talking about the Scarborough Beach foreshore, which, despite meant to be a pedestrian plaza, is still filled with cars parking all over it. We need to put bollards in. Sorry, unrelated. But, you know, whether it's that or it's climate change or indeed transit being killed by massive multi-billionaire people associated with the car industry, it's taking these issues that we don't want to necessarily look at and bringing them to the fore in a way that's fun.
Well, finally, we're going to head over to The Simpsons. And I should actually be properly nice to you and say that this whole show was your idea and you've kind of helped marshal the whole thing. So thanks for all your help and don't come after my job. But anyway, here's The Simpsons. They've been spoofing the world of urbanism for a long time too. Just tell us about the final clip.
This last clip I kind of love because, I mean, The Simpsons just has this broad cultural appeal and it is satire and it does make fun of society and contemporary issues. But I particularly like this one because it's a comment on the Bilbao effect. So the Guggenheim that Frank Gehry designed in Bilbao and the idea that, you know, you can turn these derelict parts of a city, you can transform them with cultural investment and showy architecture. And, you know, in turn, that'll bring economic uplift to an area. And that's what they're critiquing in this. So in Springfield, they wanted to build a new concert hall and they invited Frank Gehry to do it.
Frank Gehry, you're a genius. Behold, the new Springfield Concert Hall. And none of this would have happened if not for a letter I received from one little girl.
I wrote that letter.
You wrote I was the bestest architect in the world?
Well, aren't you?
All in favor of building a $30 million screw you to Shelbyville?
Aye! So at the risk of that being a spoiler for the episode, what does happen is they build the concert hall. Turns out no one in Springfield actually cares about classical music or opera, and it very quickly gets run down and turned into a state prison.
And that was actually Frank Gehry.
Yes, correct. I believe he voiced it.
Go on. Tell us, really, where can people come and see you if they're actually, when you say East Coast, you mean the East Coast of England or the East Coast of Scotland? Where?
East Coast of Australia. So February 2020, I'm doing a show in Perth and then a show in Melbourne and Sydney. So they can come and find me there.
Okay, look, he's funny. Go and see him and just be nice. Okay, thank you, Nick. Thank you very much for joining us on The Urbanist. One of the things that we attempt to do on this show is break down the barriers and make urbanism more accessible to the general public. Well, that's me, for instance. We should all be interested in what happens in our cities. And comedy plays an important role here too. There's a reason why a comedy show such as Parks and Recreation, which is a satire on this department in government, was a success with viewers. It humanises the issues that we're all kind of worried about. It brings to the surface things we can't quite grasp when we read them in newspapers and serious people talk about them on TV. So yes, continue to be invested in your city and championing change, but remember to laugh too every now and then. Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, Nick Manise and David Stevens. And David also edited the show. And to play you out of this episode, well, here's Talking Heads with Cities. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.